you're doing a guitar solo, and your rhythm guitar player is screaming in the mic, and your singer is singing, and the bass player is doing something, and he's just like, when does it come together? And I was like, that's our band. You know? I'm like...
Hey, it's January 21st, 2015. My name is Adam Sewell, and you are listening to the official Stereo Dynamite podcast. This is podcast number 001, the very first official Stereo Dynamite podcast. This first episode is with our good friend, Mr. Cactus Vela, who some of you may know as a guitar player for Toronto acoustic punk rock collective, Rebel Music Collective. The Whiskey Hearts, as well as having been the guitar player for Toronto punk rock legends, the Class Assassins, as well as the other fantastic Toronto punk rock legends, Sinking Ships. Cactus has played with a whole bunch of other bands as well, and he talks about that in the podcast. And he also owns his own graphic arts, graphic design company, and we get into that a little bit as well, and he'll talk all about it and what it's like to have been a kid from the suburbs, growing up in a small punk rock community, and eventually moving to the big city and getting caught up in all the chaos. Cactus is a great guy. He's one of those guys that, you know, just seems like he jumps out of bed and wants to sort of meet the day head on with a lot of energy and try his hand at a lot of different things and get a lot of stuff done. So while I go and put on another pot of coffee to try and combat this incredibly cold January morning, I'm going to play a song called So Cold by Toronto's Whiskey Hearts featuring Mr. Cactus Vela. The song is available on a limited edition color vinyl 7-inch at the Stereo Dynamite merch store, stereodynamite.com, and there's a link there, and you can order yourself some limited edition vinyl. And the Whiskey Hearts are playing in Toronto Saturday, February 7th at the Press Club, which is on Dundas Street West, just about three blocks west of Bathurst. The club is tiny, and the band always put on a really, really amazing show. And if you get the chance to see them, I highly recommend it. So without further delay, here is the Whiskey Hearts with So Cold, and the official Stereo Dynamite podcast number 001 with Mr. Cactus Vela.
Ready?
Knowing that I couldn't say no. Who would have thought that all it took to buy off your conscience was 15 bucks? And if you're gonna leave, then I guess I'm gonna need something that'll keep me warm. 'Cause baby, you can be so cold. You can be so cold. Keys to my heart. Well, I need them back. See them locked out on the step, and now the sun is going down. It's getting dark. Oh, how could I have known? Well, I used to think you were so cool. Oh, the coldest winter that I remember was the summer I spent with you. 'Cause baby, you can be so cold. You can be so cold.
Damn cold.
minus 40 in the old bus stop. Minus 40
in Richmond Hill sucks.
Minus 40 in Congress is what you call a true chump. You showed me what it really means, oh, to stay cold. What it means to stay cold. What it means to stay cold. What it means to stay cold. You can be so 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 cold. Cause baby, you can be so cold. You can be so cold. You can be so cold. So damn cold.
This one time I'm walking, I just did some groceries, and I got like, you know, four grocery bags in each hand. And this woman comes speed walking up behind me, and she's directly behind me. So I can like just barely turn my head and see her. And every time I turn to the left, she hits the right, back and forth. And then all of a sudden, I see this one arm just come up from the side of me and try to reach into my left pile of bags. And then as I favor to that side, she reaches to my right side and grabs a couple of things and runs. And I'm like, son of a bitch. You know, she got off with some popcorn and some ham and some...
Yeah, that's Parkdale.
That's Parkdale, yeah.
Well, that's the real Parkdale. Mm-hmm. It's not hipster Parkdale.
No, no, you mean hipster, yeah. Like, 2-hour lineups for $50 tacos.
Yeah.
That's right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Officially welcome.
All right.
To the podcast. You're not actually from Toronto originally, are you?
No, I grew up just north of Toronto in Vaughan.
What was it like up there? And how long ago was that, though?
Because
I can guarantee you Vaughan is a very different place now than it would have been.
Yeah, so my parents bought the house a few years before I was born, right? I was born in 75. And I'd say up until the age of 10, it was like small town country. We had like one grocery market. And like, you know, the gas station was like, you know, 5 miles away. And then this... big movement came in, and they started building subdivisions and buying everyone's property out, and then it was just like stacks of subdivisions that looked like Lego houses, right? And yeah, and it was a big difference then, and it was tough being a punk rocker in Woodbridge, definitely. So as soon as I got crafty enough and had a few bucks, I would like, you know, hop on the bus. And make my way to the TTC and then make my way down to Toronto. And I usually went straight to Young and Bloor and didn't even know you, man, but I was buying records off you. I was buying records off you back then, right?
So yeah, at the Record Peddler.
At the Record Peddler, yeah. But we had a little scene in Woodbridge, actually. We had about a dozen punk rockers, and then we had like, there'd be a, like, UNXL, for example, was in Aurora, and like our buddy Lenny, who the band Len was actually named after.
Okay.
Right? He was up there, you know, Mark Harper from Sinking Ships, like a whole guys I play with in the Dogs. Chris McDonald from Whiskey Hearts was in Etobicoke, so he was close. So we had all these people in surrounding areas that would just come and hang out with us on the weekends. And
so all those people now have
made their way to Toronto.
Made their way into Toronto.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, we had a good little scene for a while. It was cool.
I always envision the suburbs as sort of being, you know, hundreds and hundreds of kids coming out to sort of basement shows,
mm-hmm.
And sort of, you know, church basement type things, you know, rec centers and stuff like that. Was it like that up there?
Yeah, not really, because the majority of people there weren't into that culture. There was
Well, look, honestly, when I think of Woodbridge and I think of Vaughan, all I think of is like Italian
exactly.
disco.
Exactly. So like if you went to the McDonald's parking lot, on any given night, there'd be like 300 GTOs and IROCs and all that, right? And that's where they'd all be hanging out. And then you went to like downtown Woodbridge, this area we called Market Lane, and it was old school. And then you'd see like 12 punks sitting on a curb. And so we would throw the odd show. Some friends of ours actually all moved out around the age of like 17 and got a punk house just in the outskirts of Woodbridge in Etobicoke, Rexdale area, actually, like Islington and just a little south of Islington Steeles, and started doing punk rock shows there. And bands from Toronto would actually come and play. And then before you knew it, all these punk rockers from Toronto were making the trip up to Etobicoke, and they're like, because they heard about this punk house. So we had that kind of thing going on.
What year would that have been?
94.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was playing in a little three-piece punk band called Rejected.
Okay.
And we had, you know, it was pretty cool. It was pretty good times.
Nice.
Yeah, that was cool.
And what year did you end up moving to Toronto?
98, I think, 97, 98.
Okay.
Yeah, I started couch surfing at this punk house called the Federal House, and it was occupied by the guys that played in Two Pump Louie, that band, and the Blast Caps. Do you remember them? John Harvey. So, I started couch surfing there at a certain point, and then I just stopped going home altogether. And then one day I was like, hey, Mom, Dad, can you send my stuff down? So it was like that.
Nice.
Yep, it was time.
So between then up to playing in Whiskey Hearts now and doing solo stuff, give us a quick rundown of the punk bands that you played with.
All right. So the first band that I started gigging with in Toronto was Rejected in like 94. And that lasted till about 96. And then a few of us from Woodbridge started a band called Bomb Shelter. And that was, Mark, who played in Sinking Ships with me, Chris, who plays in Whiskey Hearts, played drums in that band, and Jason from the Dogs, and I did guitar and vocals. So that was Bomb Shelter. And we had a really good run. We were doing this mixture of new school hardcore with a sound that would later be made very well known by Hot Water Music. We had a little bit of that going on with a slight hint of Oi. Somehow it worked, you know? Somehow it worked. It was, I guess you could call it a bit of a progressive street punk kind of all thing. Right. And we did that for a while, a few years, played some really good gigs, and really learned the whole art of promoting and booking your own gigs back then. Really got into it. Really, you know, started really digging that. Unless I started getting into the mentality of, unless if somebody was going to book us something big, we'd just do it ourselves, right? So unless if we were going to support a touring band, might as well just book the local shows ourselves,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
So I did that, and then as soon as that band broke up, I didn't want to stop playing. So I remember people would call up and say, hey, can Bomb Shelter play a gig next month? I'd be like, well, we're not playing any longer, but I'll play solo. And they started doing the solo thing. And I put together a set and started playing acoustic shows anywhere I could, and did that for a while. And then I got asked to join Two Pump Louie on second guitar. We did that for a few years. That band ended, started Sinking Ships. And Sinking Ships had a good 10-year run.
Yeah.
And during the time I played in Sinking Ships, joined the Dogs, joined the Class Assassins, became a very, very busy guy in the city. gave it everything I had for a long time, right? Just focused on playing shows, tried to book as many shows as we could, and recording and having a lot of fun hitting the road. And then that leads me to now.
You recently left Class Assassins.
Yes.
And I know, I mean, Whiskey Hearts only plays every now and then.
That's right.
And you've been doing the solo acoustic thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you stop playing in the punk rock band format?
With Sinking Ships, we ran our course. There was no more magic as far as, I don't want to diss it or whatever. Like, yeah, it was a great, great band, but like,
sometimes you just know it's over.
That's right. I knew, yeah, exactly. And the friendships had been kind of compromised I think that's a good way to put it. Friendships got compromised a bit, and we weren't doing ourselves or anyone any favors by still playing. It wasn't a positive environment.
Okay.
Right? So it needed to come to an end. The Class Assassins was great. That was probably, overall, probably the best band I've ever played in. It was an honor to play with those guys. It was great. I've always been of the mind frame that if you want to become a better musician, you should play with some really, really good people.
Right.
And they'll raise your game. And that's what happened with the Class Assassins. I was a huge fan for years, and they brought me in. But that band burnt me out, man. They burnt me out. Like, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work booking that band and just, you know, keeping us.
The thing I'm wondering, though, is you strike me as being the guy, and every band has that guy.
That's right.
Who ends up taking on the majority of the behind-the-scenes work.
Exactly. Exactly. And I didn't see that coming with the Class Assassins because they'd done so well on their own for so many years. But actually, most people thought they had broken up. And they hadn't broken up. They were still playing. It's just, you know, people just didn't know about them too much anymore, right? So I came on and I was like, okay, you know, we got to get this band relevant again. And I remember we were at one of my first practices with them, and I was like, guys, you just got to stop taking such random bookings. And they're like, what do you mean? And like, literally 1 minute later, someone knocks at our jam room door, and it's some guy from the hallway down the hallway to rehearsal space. Never heard of him before. And he's like, hey, you guys sound pretty cool. You want to play a gig next Sunday at Rancho Relaxo? And then they're all like, sure. And I'm like, wait, what's the lineup? And it's like some reggae band, some funk band, you know what I mean? Some like instrumental keyboard thing and us. And I'm like, we got something else going on, sorry. And I was like, close the door, and I'm like, guys, you see what I mean? I'm like, you gotta be a little more wise with your bookings. Let's get back into it. But this isn't the way to do it, right? So it was
a few years of that can be exhausting.
That's right, exactly, right? So it was a lot of fun, yeah, but it was a lot of work with that band. Oddly, like, in the 7 years I was in the band, we were very, very productive. When I first joined, they were halfway through the final stages of putting out their new album. So my goal was to get this album out and start backing it on the road so we can move on to new material with me. So I that was my number one goal. So we got that album out. And then in the time I was in the band, we did a 7-inch, a CD, and a digital concept EP, which was really cool. We did a music video. The music video was released the week that I left the band, so, you know, it was kind of cool, right? Class Assassins was the first band I played in that my father took a liking to. He didn't like anything I ever did. He just always, you know, he thought Sinking Ships was the most chaotic mess of music he's ever heard. He's like, everyone's soloing on top of each other. He's like, you're doing a guitar solo, and your rhythm guitar player is screaming in the mic, and your singer is singing, and the bass player is doing something, and he's just like, when does it come together? And I was like, that's our band, you know? <I'm> like, right? So he didn't dig it too much, and then he heard the Class Assassins. He was like, this is good. This is rock and roll.
It's rock and roll.
It's rock and roll, yeah. So he really liked that.
So you were done with that, and then I know you had already been doing the solo acoustic thing.
That's right.
By the time that you left the Class Assassins.
Yes, I got back into the solo acoustic thing, I guess, like 4 years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago or so, and just rediscovered my passion for it again, right? And then put together Whiskey Hearts. And I don't even know what Whiskey Hearts was supposed to be. Basically, I got a regular booking at the Press Club, and they started giving me, every other Thursday, I think they started giving me at first. And then it turned into every other Saturday. And then we went to once a month. But basically, I would just put together a crew of acoustic people, and then we'd all play solo sets, but then we'd start crossing over. And then we'd start learning songs together. So at any given time, there could be like any combination of 3 or 4 people on stage. And then there started being
Was it meant to be like punk rock guys coming in,
yes,
playing?
Yeah, exactly. And then every now and then somebody would get suggested or whatever, and we'd bring them in, and we'd be like, nah, they're not punk rock, you know? You can tell when a punk rocker is playing acoustic guitar, right?
Right.
And then I guess the four of us, the core of Whiskey Hearts, started becoming a regular occurrence. And then, people started getting into it. And people would always be like, when's your band playing? I'd be like, we're not a band. We're a collective.
and the four core guys would be?
So myself, Chris McDonald, Ty Trumbull, and Matt Asselstein.
Yeah. Ty from 680 News.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Or Scoop. He goes by Scoop as well, right?
Right.
And Whiskey Hearts was awesome. It was so much fun. What happened, though, was we started doing it regularly, and then the one thing we liked about it was we wanted it to be like very free-flowing. We never liked to rehearse a lot. Like, we'd rehearse once before a gig. And just, you know, maybe show each other a couple of new things. But we like to have as much spontaneity and improv as we could. But on the flip side of that, what happens is it's really hard to write new material and your stick gets old pretty fast. So we were going up there every month doing the same thing, and we had a regular following. So people would start coming up to me going like, oh, when are you guys going to change things up? And I'd be like, oh, like it was weird. It's
yeah,
like,
that hurts.
Yeah, you know? So I'm like, okay, we'll play every other month then. And what happens? You play every other month then, and then it just kind of kills your flow a bit. And all of a sudden it starts getting harder to get people out and to commit to dates and stuff. So, you know, it is what it is. I love it to death. I wish we were a little more active than we are, but, you know, that could change too, right?
And there's a show that's coming up February
7th.
7th.
Okay. Saturday, February 7th at the Press Club, yeah.
Okay.
So really excited about that one.
And this is, who all is playing that night?
So far it's just Whiskey Hearts. I have to get some other people on the bill.
You have to find some acoustic punks.
That's right.
Kicking around.
Yeah, exactly. It won't be hard. It won't be hard.
To come from playing, you know, where you sort of, you know, you have the safety net of, you know, a wall of amps behind you and playing, you know, at maximum volume and the whole bit.
Mm-hmm.
To go from that to just you and the acoustic guitar standing in front of a room of people. How nerve-wracking is that, translating what you would normally do down to that sort of new, you know, vibe and format, if you will?
It's interesting. It's some people are freaked so out by it. There's some people are really fucked up when they do it, right? I always liked the challenge. I thought it was great the first few times I did it. I realized right away, like, I remember hitting a bum note and just being like, oh, you could really hear that. Because there's no drummer, there's no distortion, there's nothing, right? Yeah, and I'm like, I can't turn around and give the bass player a dirty look. You know? That was me. That was all me, people. So, you know, it really makes you, it raises your game once again, right? Like, you know, you really have to own that instrument and everything, right? It's a bit nerve-wracking, but it's not bad. You start having fun with it, you know? I don't get very nervous. The most nervous I've ever been is when I just got married 4 months ago and I played my wedding. And, like, I don't know if I recommend that to anyone, man. And I was like, like, my wife is like, you gonna play? And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. And then my mom's like, are you gonna play the wedding? I really wanna see you play. And I'm like, you know, I'm like, well, it's a good thing. You know, I've been playing shows in Toronto now for like 25 years. It's really important that you wait until my wedding to actually see me play, right? So, you know, so I'm like, and then my wife made a request. She wanted me to learn a particular song for her for the wedding, right? So I learned, and it's like, you know, I don't know. Rod Stewart is really tough to sing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a voice on him,
yes,
right?
He does.
Yeah. So, you know, I get up there and I'm performing for my family, and it was actually one of the best things I've ever done in my life, but cool. It was really nerve-wracking. It was really nerve-wracking. Yeah.
To me, it seems like it would be a really daunting thing, especially coming, you know, from playing, you know, street punk and what have you, to, and it's an amazing thing to see a Whiskey Hearts play,
mm-hmm.
you know, to, you know, especially someone like Ty who, you know, is pulling out banjos and things. And, I mean, can play like the devil. I mean,
he's so good.
He's a fucking great player.
Yep.
Is that, I mean, how does that feel to be playing in such a stripped down environment? Either, because I know what it is to play with on stage with somebody. Sometimes you're playing with them and sometimes you're really playing almost against each other and upping each other's game.
Right.
How is that, you know, to sort of play in that type of an environment against, you know, I shouldn't say against, but you know what I'm getting at, you know, against somebody like that who, you know, I mean, he's got lightning fast fingers.
Oh, it's inspiring. It's great. It is great because Chris and I are like, and Matt, we're very close in age, and the three of us came from the same. We were all playing in our first bands at the exact same time. Ty's a few years younger. So to see, like he's so fucking good. Like, you don't even think of it anymore. But I remember, like, seeing his first bands playing their first show. And I, you know, and like, and all of a sudden it's just like, hey, that fucking kid's better than us. You know, like, he's great. And the funny thing is, as long as our sound is right on stage, we're awesome. Because we never play venues with sound guys, really. And it's always, we all just plug right into the PA system and we're turning the knobs and making it sound the way we need it to sound.
Right.
So if something, like if you start playing and all of a sudden one of us is way too loud, it just fucks us up. So if we get the right sounds, then it's amazing because we can, because there's no distortion in drums and everything, we can hear every little thing each other's doing. So all of a sudden you'll just like do a random extra fill that you don't normally do, or you'll just like, you know, do a cool run and we'll all look at each other and smile. So it's like, oh, that's awesome you did that. Check out what I'm going to do now. So there is that bringing out the best in each other.
Is there more interaction in the acoustic environment than there would be normally with a you know, in the rock band
format? I think so, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Although in the Class Assassins, I have to say Chris Farr and myself on guitar would often try to entertain or impress each other on stage with just random little licks. Try not to be too cheesy, but just like a little extra in the riff.
Sure.
You know what I mean, right? But with Whiskey Hearts, yeah, there's a lot of that. And then every now and then a cool backup vocal that no one thought of doing. Someone pulls it off out of nowhere. And you're like, okay, you got to keep doing that. Keep doing it.
Nice.
Yeah. Cool. So that is fun. I do enjoy that.
Now, on the side, you're also doing a lot of graphic arts.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
Definitely. And how's that coming along for you?
It's great. It's great. It was, when I was really young, before I started getting serious with the guitar, I was always an artist. That was my one thing. Like, I was, and I was being encouraged by my family, by friends of the family. So I was always about that. And then I started getting into guitar a lot. When I was about 12, and I didn't do as much art as I used to. And then there came a point where I'm like, oh yeah, I love doing this shit. And I was, I started getting asked to do artwork for bands just randomly, like Max Marnar, because I had a computer 15 years ago or something, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I had a computer 15 years ago and I got Photoshop right away. So they're like, oh, can you do our layout for our 7-inch record? And I'm like, sure, I guess. Okay, and then people started like, hey, can you make a poster?
So you were the cool kid on the block with Photoshop.
Well,
so
I was one of them, yeah, exactly. And then I guess, I don't know, like five years ago or something, I'm looking in the mirror one day and I'm like, I'm fucked, I gotta get, what am I doing for a living again? You know, like this, oh shit, like my band's on a break and like, what am I doing, right? Working at a bar and I'm DJing and I'm like, what else do I do? What else do I do? And while I'm having this conversation with myself, I'm like just making shit up on Photoshop and I'm like, I'm a graphic designer, damn it. So I put together a portfolio of my own work, and then I just went freelance and started getting some clients and started a little graphic design business out of my home.
Nice.
Yeah, and I gave it a good run, and I really, really love it. And I have a nice client base. And as a bachelor, it was awesome. I was making enough. I was getting by, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, I'm engaged. And it's not cutting it anymore. So I went out, I got myself a full-time 9-to-5 job, which I love. I'm working in a shelter for homeless youth.
Cool.
And then when I come home every evening, I do a few hours of graphic design, and that's where I'm at.
You're living the domesticated dream now.
I'm trying to bring all my worlds together and create
a nice domesticated
balance.
Punk rock.
That's right. Right. That's right. You know. So then I just took the last 6 months off from gigging just to get everything in focus. And now I'm going to try to ease the music back into it. And hopefully I can balance out everything properly.
What music are you going to be bringing? Is this the acoustic solo stuff?
Yes. I'm going to start doing some more solo gigs again. Work on another solo album. Get more Whiskey Hearts going. Try to do some Whiskey Hearts gigs. Also, Whiskey Hearts went and recorded 3 songs about a year ago and never finished the vocals. So hopefully I can get the guys in the studio, we can do some more songs. And I am getting a bit of the punk rock itch, I won't lie. And like, you know, I'm just like, I don't want to play in a punk rock band. And then all of a sudden I'm like, I want to play in a punk rock band. So, and like, I don't know when it was, about 2 weeks ago, just over the course of running into the right people, I actually managed to, I'm like, okay, I just found 4 people that want to play in a punk rock band with me. And like, it didn't even take me longer than 20 minutes to put together this band.
Right.
So everyone's just basically a phone call away. It's like, hey, if I get this guy and this guy on board, do you want to do a little project? Maybe let's like play 3 shows and call it a day. And everyone was like, that's the best idea ever. You know, so.
You know, the best thing about getting older, I find, I did this with Bastard Child Death Cult.
Right.
Which was, I knew I wanted to do that band just because it was like I had the music was in my head and it felt like that music had been in my head since I'd been about 16 or 17 years old. And I was like, I never got a chance to really get that on record and I never got a chance to really have a band like that.
Right.
So I thought, I'm just going to do that and I'm going to play a couple of shows and then I'm going to call it a day. And I knew that that was going to be the extent of it. And I'll tell you, doing that, knowing that the intention was not to go out and, you know, live out of a van for 200 shows a year, And it was not to go out and try and become the biggest band in the world or anything like that. It was just to play some punk rock shows and then call it a day.
Mm-hmm.
Was the best feeling ever.
Yeah, totally.
There was no sense of disappointment at the end of the day.
That's
right. There was no regrets. There was no, it was, did exactly, we ended up doing more. I mean, we ended up touring the UK, you know, mm-hmm. which was never part of the plan. But we went and we did some cool stuff and called it a day. And I was like, it was really liberating. It was
that's
really
right.
great to be able to put the brakes on it at just the right moment and say, like, that's it. There were no regrets.
Exactly. That's what I want to do now, too. And, like, I'm like, that's what I've told these dudes that I'm friends with. I'm like, we'll get together. We'll put together a set. 3 gigs. And that's it. Just literally, that's it. No pressure. And everyone's like, I love that. I'm like, we're not a band, man. We're a project. it's a project.
You know, what's funny is I remember when I was a kid, I would always hear about these bands, you know, that, oh, dude, these guys play 3 shows and that's it. And
yes.
They ended up being legends because they played 3 shows. And people used to, you know, it was like, you know, there'd be bands and people would know these guys were only going to play 3 or 4 shows. And people would care, like they would pay attention to it. And it'd be, I think, it would be great if more people were like that and really understood that, like, you know, that there's a need to support and you can actually see really, really great stuff that burns quickly.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I mean, yep. It just, you know, just because a band doesn't have, you know, a shelf life of 5 years and make 3 records and tour the world,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't make them any less valid. You know, like if the band is good and the music is good, you know, it's worth supporting, and especially if they're only going to do 2 or 3 shows.
Exactly, exactly. And that'll be it, right? Like, it's kind of like, and you make it, I think, to an extent, you make it clear that it's only going to be that. So it's kind of be like, hey, if you want to see us, catch one of these 3 gigs, and that's it. If you don't want to see us or you don't catch the gigs, then so be it.
Right.
Right?
No, I love that idea.
Yeah, it's cool. Maybe we'll do one then.
I need to steal that idea.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. But like, you know, because you know what it is. You've been on the flip side of that. You've been like in the bands where you're like, you know, you're trying. Like you're working hard and you're
yes.
doing, you know, and it sometimes it's different for everyone. And it goes in waves, right? Sometimes you have a good time. Like Class Assassins, we had... You know, we worked our asses off, and sometimes we got treated amazingly, and sometimes we got treated really fucking poorly, man, by people that are close to us. Like, it seems like the bigger and the better gigs we played, the worse we got treated sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, like, you know, this isn't sour grapes or anything. Just like, okay, you know, like, really cool opening or supporting spots for great touring bands that we're big fans of, and it's kind of like, okay, we're going to need you to... play first at 7 p.m., but you got to be there at 4 with all your gear, and you're going to have to let every band use your gear, and we got no money for you. We'll try to throw you a beer or two, but and make sure you promote the show, man.
Right.
You know what
right.
I mean? There was a lot of that, right? And it's like, thank God we sell merch. You know what I mean? Right? Because we're like, 4 p.m., okay, we're all taking a day off work, right?
Like, I get the give and take, and I get yeah. sometimes you have to... You've got to eat it.
Oh, and we always did.
Like sometimes, but there is the odd time where you just got to put your foot down and you just know it's not going to be worth it at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah.
There was a time we did a show with Bastard Child Death Cult where we had just finished touring the UK and we came back to Toronto and we did our own show and it was amazing. It was this great show that we did at Hard Luck
yeah.
and... Everything about it was really cool, and we were all feeling good. And then we went and did a show a couple of weeks later, opening for another band. And just the complete disrespect was mind-blowing.
Really?
Like,
eh?
It was just... It was really funny. Like, it was just really, you know... The attitude that was thrown at us was just really like, oh, you guys are just a local band anyways, and you'll always be around. You play a lot, so it's, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And that was when I knew, I'm like, I'm done. Like,
mm-hmm.
if that's the point, like, where, you know, you're out and you're busting your ass and you're touring, you're doing the stuff and you build up stuff on your own, and then you go to actually work with somebody else on another show.
Yes.
And you get treated like that.
Mm-hmm.
And because people just sort of, you know, want to, I mean, they really do take you for granted after a while.
Yes.
And they really just assume you'll always be available and you'll always be willing to eat shit just to play whenever.
That's right.
And I was like, that's it, I'm fucking done. That was the straw that broke the camel's back for me. Mm. And I was like, okay, I'm done. You know, and I can totally empathize with,
yeah,
with having to go through that.
But exactly. But it was never a big deal. It was just kind of like, really, again? Okay, but you know, we, like I said, we had some amazing gigs. Like my first gig with the Class Assassins was supporting DOA. And then, like, you know, literally 2 months later, we were on the Bad Religion show, the Bronx. We did the Horror Pops. We had this great run.
That's excellent.
Yeah, we did Dropkick Murphys twice. We landed at an opening spot for Dropkick Murphys at Sound Academy. It's like 4,000 people, 3,000 people or something. And then a year and a half later, they come back and they request us. And so, like, Live Nation has no choice at that point. Live Nation, like, Class Assassins, you've been requested for Dropkick Murphys.
That's great. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Exactly, right? So it was, you know, it was really good. Live Nation got really mad about the amount of beer that we were buying off them. So, like, they give you a free 2-4 or something, right? And, like, you know, and we got all these backstage passes and we have our own dressing room. So we have all of our friends back there. And, like, the 2-4 is gone in, like, an hour, right? So then they're like, okay, you get a discount on your beer. So we order a couple more 2-4s at a discounted rate. And then by the time we got to, like, the third one or fourth one, they're like, you're cut off. Go buy them at the bar. And and I'm like, oh boy.
Well, you know,
that's fine.
That's
fine.
Rock and roll for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's the reality of backstage.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Totally.
It's not the what's the word I'm looking for? It's not the Caligula like. No.
Now you've done lots of festivals, right?
I've done a handful. Yeah. I have done a handful. Yeah.
Isn't it awesome when you know, you're waiting. It's your turn. The roadies, the stage techs, they got all your stuff on stage in seconds. You're playing, you're treated like, you know, do you need anything? Do you need a towel? Do you need water? Right? Hit that last note on your guitar, you turn over your back, and the roadies are pulling your amps off the stage already, and all of a sudden, that's it. Boom. See you later. It's awesome. Well,
I've done a few. Ozfest,
right,
was one, the first time we played on the main stage, and a guy actually stood on the side of the stage with a big clock, and he held it, and he would point to it between every song.
And it wasn't Flavor Flav, right?
No. And he just had this deadpan, like, harsh look on his face.
Wow.
And I can remember playing through the last song and watching that clock tick down and him start to, you know, tap the clock. and like this road, you know, set of roadies at the side of the stage, like, ready to go on his call to just grab everything in sight.
Jeez.
And so we're like speeding up the last little bit of the song, just trying to get out of there. And it was like, you know, what ends up happening is instead of playing the song the way you're supposed to play it and playing to the people you want to play to, you're playing to the fucking guy with the clock, just trying to keep him happy.
Right.
And so, okay, finish in time and get off. And then they tear your shit off and everything. We learned a long time ago, though, with Monster Voodoo Machine, you know, we used to get tours all the time because we would practice tearing down. Like, when we would practice to play a show, we would tear our gear down, put it out in the hallway, start a clock, run in, set up, play our set, tear down, pack up, and put the shit back out in the hallway. And that's what we considered a rehearsal.
That is brilliant.
And so we figured out how to do that so quickly that we would go and play with bands and they'd be like, oh, you guys are great, so come on tour with us because you don't fuck around.
Oh, man.
And so we you know, that's how we got a Carcass tour. Carcass and Life of Agony ended up taking us out because we could do that.
Wow.
That's smart.
That's really smart. That's impressive.
Everyone
in the band, though, needs to be on that level, right? Because you get that one guy in the band that's like, that's lame, man.
No, there was no room for that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's how I got a bad reputation with guys, was just because I treated it like a military exercise more than anything else.
That's fine. That's really fine. It paid off.
I was, you know, at the time, I was an asshole. But when we ended up getting tours because of it and stuff, I was like, oh, yeah, we knew it all the time. Yeah, sorry.
That's funny.
It's all good. Mm. Well, hey, listen, thank you for coming by and doing this, man.
Awesome. Thank you.
I appreciate it. So Whiskey Hearts, February 7th at the Press Club.
That's right.
And that's Dundas and...
just a few blocks west of Bathurst.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Cactus.
Thank you very much, man. Thank you.
Thanks.